Hey, but if I've done nothing wrong, I'll fight to the death to prove it. There's nothing more important in my life than the name I leave my kids. For years, there have been whispers, and some talk louder than whispers, that in my desire to get back at Elliot Spitzer, I hired a private detective to shadow him, and that it was my detective sleuthing that ultimately led to Spitzer's downfall. The following is my story, and I'm sticking to it. On March 10, 2008, I came into the city to attend another dinner, this one at the Tribeca Grill in honor of Medal of Honor recipients. Dick Grasso was going to be the host. I had arranged to have a drink beforehand at the Four Seasons, and my friend Ed Herlihy and Tony Carbonetti, who'd been Rudy Giuliani's chief of staff when Rudy was mayor. Ed and Tony and I were sitting in a banquette in the grill room discussing a business deal when Spitzer's name came up. Rumors about his indiscretions had been swirling, and the news of his scandal had finally broken that afternoon, pushing everything else off the front page. Tony lowered his voice. I got a call today from a friend of mine who told me a couple of months ago he was waiting in line at the Grand Central Post Office, and who was standing in front of him but the governor of the state of New York, Elliot Spitzer. And when Spitzer's turn came, he bought a $2,800 money order. Tony gave Ed and me a look. I got it. What was the governor of the state of New York doing standing in line at the post office? He had secretaries, he had security guards, he had all kinds of lackeys. What on earth might the governor of the state of New York have needed a $2,800 money order for? I'll leave it all up to your imagination. How the story of the sighting of Spitzer in line at the post office got out, how it turned into a rumor that I had hired a detective, and how or if the whole thing was related to Spitzer's unmasking, I also leave to your imagination. Was I thrilled that he got caught? What do you think? Anyway, I said goodbye to Ed and Tony and went downtown to the Medal of Honor dinner. And I don't know how the press knew I was going to be there, but when I got there, I saw a gaggle of TV trucks and cameras and mic booms. Dick had played it smart and gone in the back door. Stupid me, I went in the front, and the reporters grabbed me. The subject was Spitzer. What do you know, they asked. I told them the truth, that I didn't know anything. But I also said, we all have our own private hells, whether it's a sick kid or a bad marriage. We all have something that's on our shoulders. We all have our own private hells. I just hope his is a little hotter than everybody else's. And on July 1, 2008, Dick Grasso and I got legal vindication when the New York State Court of Appeals dismissed all claims against us, ruling that because the New York Stock Exchange was now a subsidiary of a for-profit multinational corporation, in 2006 the exchange had merged with the Chicago-based Archipelago Exchange. The state of New York had no oversight over the company's affairs and that the former prosecution was not in the public interest. Sweet victory. As for Spitzer, I feel he deserves every bad thing that's happened to him. Now, the tragedy of all this, for me, is that a basic tenet of my faith is forgiveness. But I can't find it in my heart to forgive Elliot Spitzer. Dick and I had the wherewithal to defeat him. Many others weren't so lucky. He destroyed lives and careers just because he wanted a headline. What he did to his wife and his children was miserable. And he made me a hero. After he resigned, people would come up to me on the street and shake my hand. Hey, go get him. Thank God for guys like you, they'd say. Well, I thank God every morning for all I've received and pray to be a better person. And maybe it makes me a worse person not to be able to forgive that schmuck. If that's what I have to live with, I'll live with it. Let's end the chapter on a more positive note. When Elaine and I gave $100 million to NYU Medical Center in 1999, we stipulated that the gift be anonymous. And when we donated another $100 million a few years later, we made the same stipulation. Only this time, things turned out differently. Bob Grossman and Marty Lipton came to me and said they were certain that if Elaine and I were willing to attach our names to the medical center, others would be more willing to come forward with major gifts. As it turned out, they were right in spades. The medical center's name today, NYU Langone, brings a great deal of pride, and at the same time, as a Catholic, I know pride is a mortal sin. My argument would be that my pride has less to do with vanity than with the knowledge that I've helped others to do a great deal of good. When Bob Grossman took over as CEO of NYU Medical Center in 2007, our medical school was ranked 34th nationally, and our hospital didn't even make the honor roll. Within a decade, both were in the top dozen. We've been number one in quality patient care and safety for the last 3 years. I thought that nothing in my business life could top the success of Home Depot. I can't tell you how much more the success of the medical center means to me, and I love Home Depot. Don't forget, I took the NYU job when I was 65 years old. At that age, most guys are looking for some pasture to chew grass in. At that age, I helped bring new life to an institution that in the years since has healed tens of thousands of people. 16 years on, helping that institution get to where it is now continues to be the most exhilarating experience I've ever had. Marty Lipton, thank you, thank you, thank you. Chapter 8, Human Nature and Other Disasters. Everybody talks about the bottom line, but as I've seen time and time again, you ignore the human element of business at your own peril. Most of the seven deadly sins can and do come into play, and chemistry between people, good chemistry or bad, always has an effect, sometimes a huge effect, in boardrooms, in executive suites, in sales meetings. I've had quite a few chemistry lessons over the years. This story starts in the spring of 1999 when I'd recently joined the board of General Electric. I'd been on the board for only 2 months when Jack Welch said, "I want you on the Comp Committee, a.k.a. the Management Development and Compensation Committee, or MDCC. Coming from Jack, it sounded less like a request than a direct order. Now, normally a GE, the chairman appoints committee members in consultations with the government's nominating committee. But Jack was Jack, and it was his call. "Jack," I said, "you've got guys here who've been here 10 or 15 years. Is that going to sit well?" God bless Jack. He knew what he wanted, and he didn't hold back. "I don't give a fuck," he said. "I want you on that committee." "Okay," I said. Sure enough, as soon as the announcement was made, a guy who'd been on the board for 9 years, he was the head of a major bank, went to Jack and said, "I've been here 9 years. Why didn't you put me on that committee?" Jack says to him, "I don't want some fucking banker telling me what I should pay my people. I want an entrepreneur who understands the importance and value of talent." That's Jack, and that was that. Welch was turning 65 in November 2000, then that was GE's mandatory retirement age. He was due to leave the company at the end of the year. There had been speculation for years about his successor, articles in all the business magazines. Lots of names were flying around. But by mid-2000, the list had narrowed to three people: Jeff Immelt, Jim McNerney, and Bob Nardelli. Immelt, as I said earlier, was head of the Medical Systems Division. McNerney had been the executive VP of GE Capital and CEO of GE Aircraft Engines and GE Lighting. Nardelli was head of GE Power Systems. All three had been protégés of Welch's, and each man, with good reason, saw himself as Jack's logical successor. Jack had set it up that the two guys who didn't get his job would get a very wet financial kiss from GE, but they would leave the company. It made perfect sense from a psychological standpoint. Welch didn't want two guys still at GE who, in the world's eyes and their own, had been passed over. He was going to give them packages that, when they went someplace else, would have to be met by the company they moved to. This created the opportunity for Home Depot to hire one of the two. Let's rewind a moment. In 1999, Bernie Marcus and I had passed the reins to Arthur Blank, who had been running Home Depot for about 3 years. Bernie still sat on the board. One day we were having an executive committee meeting, and I said, "Arthur, if you get hit by a train, who is your replacement? We haven't got one." "We don't have someone in the company who could step up?" He said, "No, we don't." "That won't do," I said. Arthur agreed. So we hired one of the best-known headhunters in the business, Jerry Roach of Heidrick & Struggles. We told Jerry there was no rush. Arthur was going to be chairman and CEO. We were going to bring in a president and COO. A CEO is more strategy and big picture. He's responsible for overseeing the COO, who's in charge of the numbers, the results. The CEO is the interface with the board of directors and their lead director, of course. We told Jerry there was no rush, but in very short order, he said, "Well, what about the two guys who don't get Jack Welch's job?" It made perfect sense. All three of the candidates for GE's top spot were world beaters, established leaders in their own right, eminently qualified to run the day-to-day operations of a major corporation like Home Depot. I talked with Bernie and Arthur about it, and they agreed with me. I went to see Jack. Jack, I said, do me a favor. When you've decided who's going to succeed you, let me know. Jack knew right away what I was driving at. Stay the fuck away from my guys, he yelled. Don't you dare go near them. He was afraid I was going to approach Immelt, Modelli, and McNerney before he made his decision, unbalancing his decision-making process. Three candidates had different skills and talents, but Welch swore to me they were neck and neck. I tried to calm him down. I'm not going to front-run you, Jack. All I'm saying is, when you've decided who you're picking, I'll take seconds on the other two. Welch had previously told the GE board that he wanted each of the three candidates to get 3 million stock options on top of the benefits they'd already had. It was a very canny move on Jack's part. For the two guys who would not get the top job, this piece of largesse only had immediate value after they left the company. GE stock hadn't yet reached the strike price, so they'd be walking away empty-handed. But any outside company either runner-up went to would be compelled to compensate him for his loss by matching the value of those 3 million options. Oh, shit, I thought. This is going to cost us, Home Depot, a lot of money. I spent the last weekend in October in, of all places, the Meadows, an addiction treatment facility in Arizona. I wasn't the patient. It was one of our senior people who had a bad enough drinking problem that Bernie and Arthur and I had to order him to go away. And the saddest thing was that it was family weekend at the Meadows, and this guy had been divorced a couple of times and had no family to come out to spend family weekend with him, so I volunteered. It was quite a scene. Basically, family members sitting in circles and screaming at each other, you did this, you did that. I didn't do any screaming, but I supported my guy the best I could. And on Sunday night, I flew to Greenville, South Carolina, where GE was having a board meeting. I got to the hotel around 11 p.m., to find three or four of my fellow directors sitting around having a drink. What's going on? I said. Immelt's getting the job, they told me. Wow, okay, naive me. I believed Jack when he told me the three guys were neck and neck, but it turned out that it was likely all along he was going to pick Jeff. McNerney was out early, and I think Welch felt Immelt had more gravitas, more CEO presence than Nardelli. Jeff was a Dartmouth graduate. He had an MBA from Harvard. Nardelli's B.A. was from Western Illinois. He got his M.B.A. at the University of Louisville. With the turbulence and decline in value GE suffered after Jeff took over, I wonder whether Jack now regrets his choice. Maybe Nardelli wasn't polished enough for GE, but he was perfect for Home Depot. I had a dossier on him made up and sent copies to Bernie and Arthur. At the meeting the next morning, I went up to Welch and said, Jack, do me a favor. I'm not going to do anything right now, but let me know when I can approach Nardelli. Don't you do a fucking thing, Jack said. I've got this thing all planned. The Friday after Thanksgiving, he told me he was going to send a plane to pick up Immelt and his wife and bring them down to his home at Palm Beach so he could tell Jeff he had the job. The plane's manifest would have somebody else's name on it so nobody would be the wiser. That Sunday night, Jack continued, he would fly to Cincinnati where McNerney was running GE Aircraft Engines to tell Jim that he didn't have the job. Then he would fly from Cincinnati to Schenectady, where Nardelli was running GE Power Systems, to tell Bob he didn't have the job. And then on Monday morning at 8 o'clock, Jack said, we'll make a public announcement. Okay, I told Jack, I'll do nothing until Monday morning at 8 o'clock. The whole thing went as planned. On Friday after Thanksgiving, Immelt found out he had the job. On Sunday, Welch flew to Cincinnati to tell McNerney, who, by the way, went to work as CEO of 3M on Tuesday morning. He set it up sometime earlier. Nardelli was hit hard by the news. When Jack flew to Schenectady and told Bob he didn't get the job, Nardelli argued with him. Why, Bob said. Look at my numbers, look at those guys, and look at me. I've delivered. Bob, it's my decision, Jack said, and this is the way it is. I went to California on Sunday of Thanksgiving weekend. Whenever I went to the West Coast, I stayed on New York time, and that Monday I woke up at 4 a.m. and turned on CNBC. Jack said he would embargo the announcement until 8 a.m. New York time, but because GE owned NBC, he gave CNBC a half-hour head start to announce that Immelt had the job. At 4:30 a.m. my time, I quickly picked up the phone and called Jerry Roche. Get to Nardelli right now and make sure you get to him, I said. Tell him we want to talk to him. Roche called me right back. Got him. I called Nardelli. Bob, I know you're disappointed, I said, but I've got a great opportunity for you. 2 days later, Bernie flew to Schenectady and had dinner with Nardelli. When the dinner was over, Bernie called me and said, that's the guy. Bernie was on board, and so was Arthur. The following weekend, we flew Bob and his wife to Atlanta to look at Home Depot's corporate headquarters in Atlanta, and on Sunday, 6 days after he'd been passed over at GE, we offered Nardelli the position of chief operating officer. The whole thing was a whirlwind. Bob met with the chairman of all our board committees. We had the comp committee come in and talk with Bob about his pay package. It was understood that we had to match his 3 million GE stock options with options in Home Depot stock equal to that value. At that point, GE was trading at around $50 per share and Home Depot at about $35. That night, coincidentally, there was a Heidrick & Struggles partners dinner in Atlanta, so Jerry Roche was also in town. And Jerry dropped by to see us. We were having a meeting of the executive committee at the Four Seasons Hotel and said, oh, by the way, guys, Nardelli will only take a job if he's made president and CEO. Having dropped this little bombshell, Roche went off to his dinner, leaving the six of us on the committee, Arthur, Bernie, Mitch Hart, John Clendenin, Bonnie Hill, and myself, sitting there in silence. Well, here we are, I finally said. You won't come on as COO. What do we do? Arthur suddenly said, if he wants to be CEO, it's okay with me. As lead director, I spoke up. Gee, Arthur, that's really magnanimous, I said. Why don't you excuse yourself and let us talk, and we'll get back to you. We had a suite in the hotel, and Arthur went up there, and the minute he left the room, all of us breathed a sigh of relief. Home Depot was having serious morale problems at that point, and Arthur, who was letting personal issues distract him, was part of the problem. Not only that, the rival chain Lowe's was showing great strength and beginning to get at us. What do we do, guys? I asked my fellow directors. Everyone agreed we had to take Arthur up on his offer to let Nardelli replace him as CEO. The only thing we couldn't agree on, who was going to be the one to go upstairs and tell Arthur. He was our friend and the co-founder of the company, present at the creation, a great guy who slipped a little bit. Everybody slips from time to time. But who wants to be the one who calls him on it? Nobody. That's human nature. We all sat there for almost an hour stewing about it. Okay, Bernie, why don't you go up and tell him, I said. He said it's okay with him. Oh, no, no, Bernie said. You've got to go do it. Why do I have to do it, I asked. You've got to go do it, Bernie repeated. But Bernie, you're the chairman. Bernie wouldn't budge. No, no, you've got to do it. Finally, I went upstairs and knocked on the door of the suite. Arthur was watching a football game. Arthur, I said, the board is really impressed with your position about what's good for the company, and we've decided we'll accept your offer. We're going to make Bob president and CEO. Well, Arthur went ballistic. Get out of here, he yelled. I don't want to see you. Wait a minute, I said, Arthur. You mean you were not in good faith when you said it's okay with me? Why didn't you just say, I want the job, and let us have to make the decision? Were you just maneuvering to get a vote of confidence? That really disappoints me. Arthur was really upset. Get the fuck out of here, he said. I want to see Bernie. I want to see Bernie. I went back downstairs. Bernie, I said, now I understand why you didn't want to go see him. What happened? He blew up, I said. He wants no part of me. He wants to see you. You've got to go up there with me, Bernie said. I said, I'm not going with you. Bernie shook his head. He didn't want to face Arthur alone. Human nature. You've got to come with me, he said. All right, I finally said, and we went upstairs. The minute we walked into the room, Arthur pointed at me and said, you get the fuck out of here. I got out, and Bernie had to deal with Arthur himself. Arthur calmed down. Maybe he understood he had as much reason to be upset with himself as anybody else had, and accepted the position of non-executive chairman. We called Nardelli and told him we were going to make him president and CEO, and said we were going to have a board meeting that same night to approve his package, which included the very pricey proposition of making him whole on what he'd left at GE. But now it was getting close to Christmas, and Bob very kindly invited Elaine and me to the GE Power Systems holiday party in Schenectady, the last one he would preside over. Every division of GE had its own Christmas party, and they were lavish affairs. Barry Manilow performed at Nardelli's shindig. Anyway, Elaine and I went, and from the moment I walked in the door, I knew we'd picked the right guy to head Home Depot. Bob's people were literally crying about his departure, weeping. The affection they had for this man was so powerful. The division's union rep stood up at the party and said, there will never be another Bob Nardelli again for us. Holy shit, I said to myself. Everybody loves him. He's a real people guy. We've got a real operator here. So Nardelli came to work, and he really was a great operator. For the first 4 years he was at Home Depot, every single thing he touched turned to gold. It was remarkable. He grew earnings at 20% a year for 5 full years. That's unheard of. Remember what Bob said to Jack Welch when Jack told him he was passing him over for ML. Look at my numbers. Bob was all about the numbers, and his numbers were amazing. He slashed costs across the whole organization. He consolidated division executives' responsibilities, which allowed him to cut a number of managers loose. He had a computerized inventory system installed at our Atlanta headquarters. There was a management method at GE called Six Sigma, a set of statistical tools for maximizing output and minimizing variability. To Jack Welch, it was gospel, and Nardelli, whom some people used to call Little Jack, was Jack's most passionate disciple. Nardelli brought Six Sigma to Home Depot. He also brought along his own general counsel, Frank Fernandez. I thought that was an unusual move, maybe a little worrying. He also brought in a former HR guy from General Electric, Dennis Donovan, a guy who lived on charts and percentages. Donovan was maniacal about these percentages. He always had a statistic to back up every conclusion. The only problem was that Home Depot's great strength was and still is its culture, and our culture isn't about statistics. In our culture, you don't measure the intangible value of a sales associate saying to a customer, "Can I help you?" Or, "You don't really need that. Come over here and look at this. It doesn't cost as much, but you'll be fine with it." A story. One Saturday morning at one of our stores out on Long Island, a customer comes in with a stem from his bathroom faucet and says to a sales associate, "Give me a new one of these. Now remember, I'm the son of a plumber. If you look at a faucet, it's got a handle and an escutcheon. That's the shield under the handle. And beneath the escutcheon, inside the sink, you've got the guts. The way it works is the handle turns the stem or shaft. At the end of the shaft, there's a washer. The washer fits into what's known as a seat. And when you shut the faucet, the washer presses against the seat and the water can't come up. Now, if that washer is old and brittle, the water comes through and you get a drip." "What's wrong with the faucet?" the kid asked the customer. The sales associate's about 28. To me, anybody under 80 is a kid. "Well, it drips," the guy says. "The reason it drips, look at your washer," the kid says. "Come on with me." He goes over to the plumbing department, and he takes a little 39-cent glassine bag of assorted washers off the display, opens it, takes the right-size washer out, and unscrews the screw on the guy's faucet assembly that holds the washer in, takes out the old washer, puts the new one in, and screws the screw back in. "There you go," the kid tells the guy. "Go back home and put it back in. I'm sure it'll be fine." And lo and behold, the guy went home, put the faucet back in, and it was fine. Drip gone, problem solved. He paid nothing. About 3 or 4 months later, the guy's wife wants a new kitchen, and she wants to go to some foo-foo kitchen showroom place. The husband says, "Oh, no, I want to go see my friend at Home Depot." They go in the store. The guy goes up to the same kid and says to him, "We're looking for a new kitchen, and we'd like you to help." "Let me take you over to Roz," the kid says, and takes them to meet the woman who's the kitchen designer. "Will you please take care of them?" the kid says. Bottom line, the couple bought a brand new kitchen, appliances, cabinets, flooring. It was close to a $100,000 job. That's not statistics. Between 2000 and 2005, Nardelli nearly doubled Home Depot sales. During this time, the company's revenue increased from $45 billion to over $81 billion. He grew net earnings after taxes from $2.5 billion to $5.6 billion. But during the same period, Home Depot stock stayed more or less stagnant, while Lowe's stock price doubled. Back when the company had first started, I'd recommended a policy requiring every director to visit 3 Home Depot stores every 90 days, casually dressed and as inconspicuous as possible, and report on his or her findings. What the directors were now finding on the store visits was that something was amiss. Wall Street analysts were also reporting the same issues. Morale problems in the stores and company-wide an inordinate focus on Nardelli's pay package. The market had picked up on our troubles. Within 3 months of Nardelli's taking the reins, this was early 2001, it was obvious there was a problem between Arthur and Nardelli. That spring, Bob came to us and said, "Look, this isn't working." So we held a special board meeting at the airport in Palm Beach and we talked around and around about the subject for a while, trying to tell Arthur politely that the management structure wasn't working as it was then constituted, until finally Frank Borman, the tough old fighter pilot, Frank had joined the board in 1980, spoke up. "Hey, Arthur, don't you get it?" Frank said. "It's time for you to move on." Arthur didn't protest. He was stunned. He went home, though he went home a very wealthy man. The next thing we heard, the Atlanta Falcons were up for sale, and Arthur bought the team. Bernie remained chairman for a little while, but at the beginning of 2002, he stepped down, and Nardelli added chairman to his other titles. And the company was still hurting. Nardelli had made no friends among the division executives, and his store-wide program of trimming back product knowledge sales associates, like that kid who gave away the washer, and replacing them with cheap part-time help, was sweetening our bottom line, but souring customer relations. There was also a pet idea of Bob's, the Store Leadership Program, or SLP. Nardelli thought that installing college graduates and ex-military officers as store managers would improve performance and class up our whole operation. It sounded like a good idea on paper. I remembered going into a Home Depot on Long Island and talking to the manager, a West Point graduate who'd come in under the SLP. He was clearly a smart guy, but when I asked him about his ambitions for the store, he said, "Oh, I'm just here for the time being. I've got my sights set on Atlanta," meaning an executive position at corporate headquarters, meaning his own store would receive anything but his full attention. Meanwhile, Lowe's was continuing to gain on us. There was also the continuing issue of Bob's compensation. As you'll remember, the early years of the 21st century, and here we circle back around to the Enron and WorldCom scandals breaking then, and the fight I was starting to have with Spitzer over Grasso's pay, with a silly season for CEO compensation stories. Executive pay was the hot-button item, and Nardelli became a poster boy. The business journals were reporting that Bob's options were worth over $200 million. But they didn't have that monetary value at that point, nothing like it. By applying a commonly used financial formula called the Black-Scholes model, you could place a theoretical value of about $40 million on Nardelli's options. But Home Depot stock would have to rise significantly for that value to become real, and there was no guarantee, especially with Lowe's beating us like a drum, when or if Home Depot stock would go that high. Bob's contract called for him to make between $15 and $16 million a year, including bonuses. And every year between 2000 and 2005, we paid him twice that. That's how good his numbers were. But just like everyone in the business community, we on our board of Home Depot were reading all those headlines about that supposed $200 million pay package. And even though the stories weren't true, appearances, optics matter. We held a special meeting of the executive committee. Bonnie Hill was chair of compensation. She suggested, and we all agreed, that for the sake of appearances, we would pay Bob $1 million less than we paid him the last year. In 2006, that is, instead of $31 million, he would make $30 million. Still almost $15 million over what his contract called for. We called him in. First, we talked about his numbers, music to Bob's ears. We told him what a great job he'd done and how pleased we were. And then we said, "Bob, for cosmetic purposes, we're going to ding you $1 million this year." He stood straight up, right there in the boardroom, as if he'd gotten a jolt of electricity. "Why are you doing this to me?" he yelled. "I worked harder this year than last. You should be paying me more, not less." He went on and on like that. "Look at my numbers." And then he stormed out of the room. We all sat there stunned. My seat was next to his, because I was lead director. I looked around and said, "I'll be back in a minute." I got up and I went to Bob's office. "You get back in that fucking room," I told him. "You don't ever disrespect that board again like that, ever. You get back in that room and you apologize to those people. We're paying you $14 million more than we owe you. We don't have to give you $14 million extra dollars. We're giving it to you, Bob. You did a great job. We just think that for your benefit and our benefit, it would be better to get below the radar, and that's what we're trying to do. We think $1 million does it." He looked hesitant for a moment. "Just think about what you just did," I said. He thought about it, then he went back in and apologized. But the damage was done, and the headlines kept coming. The executive committee continued to talk about how to get Nardelli and his $240 million off the front page. Soon after the meeting with Bob, It was around Labor Day 2006. I went to my place in the North Carolina mountains, around a 2.5-hour drive from Atlanta, for a couple of weeks. I looked out at those beautiful trees and hills, and I thought and thought. Then I suddenly had an idea. Home Depot stock was still in the mid-30s then, so Nardelli's options weren't in the money yet. Now, we could have asked Bob to give back some of his options just to get down below that inflammatory and theoretical number of $240 million. But I knew Bob too well by now to think he'd give anything back. What about instead of taking something from Nardelli, we were to give something to Home Depot stockholders? My brainstorm was to ask Bob to agree not to exercise his options until the stock rose to 15% above his strike price and stayed there for a period of time. That way he would get to keep all his options, all the investors would be making money, and the business journals would get to marvel at his generosity. A win-win-win. It was a Sunday night. I called Jack Welch up. He was retired and living on Nantucket. And I said, "Jack, I have an idea." I told him about it. "Brilliant," Jack said. "That's a brilliant idea. He should absolutely do it." So I phoned Nardelli and told him I wanted to see him in the morning. And first thing Monday, I drove down to Home Depot's headquarters in Atlanta and told Bob about my plan over lunch in his office. "Bob," I said after I'd explained it, "this solves everything. There's no downside for you. Because they weren't qualified options," I said, "he would have to pay income taxes on all the shares he bought at the exercise price, even if he didn't turn around and sell them. The stockholders and the business journals would get to see what an upright, selfless guy he was." He shook his head. "Well, I don't know if I'll be happy if I do it," he said. "Listen, Bob, you know yourself better than I know you. If you don't think you're going to be happy, then you probably don't want to do it." "Well, let me think about it," he said. "Fine," I said. In the car on my way back to North Carolina, I phoned Welch. "Jack," I said, "he's going to call you." I phoned Jack again when I got back to the mountains Monday night. "Yeah, he called me," he said. "He's thinking like a damn immigrant." "What do you mean?" I asked. "He's not going to do it," Jack said. "I told him your plan was brilliant, that he wouldn't have to give up anything, and that he could hold on to everything. He wasn't buying." The fact is that Nardelli was acting like an immigrant instead of the CEO of a $90 billion company. He was fixated on what was essentially a petty matter, the details of his compensation, instead of Home Depot's overall strategy. He lived in a permanent state of feeling ripped off, just like a guy who can't get over being dumped by a girl. He'd never gotten over Welch's not choosing him for the top spot at GE. Not long after he came to Home Depot, Fortune did an article about Immelt taking the reins. The reporter talked to Bob, and Bob was still talking about his numbers, still arguing about why Welch should have chosen him instead of Jeff. "I told Jack I need an autopsy here," Nardelli said to the reporter. "Let's exhume the body." Not the most felicitous choice of words. At 11:30 a.m., on the day the magazine hit the stands, Jack Welch calls me up. "You fucking guineas," he yells, "you never get over anything. Tell that guy he didn't get my job and to get on with his life." But Bob never got over not getting the GE job. And every time he had a chance to stick at the GE, he did. One of the first moves he made at Home Depot was to substitute Philips light bulbs for GE light bulbs at all 2,300 stores across the country. Now, you could argue that it was the right thing for our customers because the Philips light bulbs cost the same but lasted 30% longer. It was scientifically verifiable, so you could advertise it, and the customer went for it. But take a step back for a second. Do you write down the date when you change the light bulb? Damn right you don't, and neither does anyone else. Well, Nardelli didn't care how long the damn light bulbs lasted once they were screwed in. All he cared about was screwing GE. But light bulbs weren't the only thing Bob changed at all 2,300 stores. He knew the store managers were grumbling about him because he was leaning on the managers to drive sales and cut costs, to push their people harder and slash overtime. And so in response to the grumbling, he installed a human resources person at every Home Depot location in the United States to the tune of around $100,000 per annum per HR representative. Do the math. That's a lot out the window every year for a function that arguably wasn't necessary outside corporate headquarters. But Nardelli felt it was necessary in the stores, and I don't think it was for the reason he gave out. Morale in the stores continued to be lousy. People were leaving. Home Depot's mission and culture were in question. You could make the case that the HR representatives in each store were there to ease staff concerns, but you could also make the case they were there to monitor discontent and report it to Bob Nardelli. The store managers began to feel that these HR people were Nardelli spies. Morale sank even further, company-wide. When I went to Bob and told him that I had been in the stores and morale was not good, he said, "They're a bunch of crybabies." "Bob, they may be a bunch of crybabies to you, but they're the most precious thing we have," I said. "They're the only thing that separates us from everybody else. They're our secret source, our secret weapon. They're what make us what we are as a company." It was beginning to dawn on me that in his early days at Home Depot, Nardelli had acted like the people guy he'd been at GE. But that was when he could rack up good numbers by making changes, like switching the store's return policy from cash refunds to store credit. That didn't hurt anybody. He was picking low-hanging fruit. Once the low-hanging fruit was gone, Bob got tougher, but counterproductively so. I realized that Bob was really just a people guy on the surface, that he made himself love the GE only in imitation of Jack Welch, who, as tough as he was, truly was a people guy. Bob Nardelli liked being seen as Little Jack because he wanted to inherit Big Jack's job. Around this time, early in the summer of 2006, two of Home Depot's directors, Greg Brenneman and Labe Jackson, called me and said they felt Nardelli's leadership was not helping the company. I held back on voicing an opinion. At fall of 2006, it was 5.5 years into Bob's tenure, an activist investment fund out in San Diego called Relational Investors began to take an interest in Home Depot. Activist funds critique companies they're invested in and suggest improvements. In theory, this is all to the good for a company and its stockholders, but it can get coercive and counterproductive. If the company doesn't follow the fund's suggestions, the fund may mount a proxy fight to gain control, or at the very least get active in a very public way, much as Nelson Peltz had done at GE and Paul Singer with Arconic, formerly Alcoa, before he actually did launch a proxy fight. I didn't know about relational investors at first. I just had the uneasy sense that with our stock flat and company morale down, somebody might be coming after us. So at our November board meeting, my fellow directors and I, Bob included, decided to retain my friend Marty Lipton, who's recognized as the number one guy in the world in corporate governance, and his firm Wachtell Lipton, in case anybody out there was considering agitating for changes at Home Depot. If anybody came after us, we agreed, our first call would be to Marty Lipton. At a meeting like that, the agenda is the agenda, but you always try to read between the lines. And one thing I could instantly see in that boardroom was how poisonous things had become between Nardelli and the directors. Afterward, I called Bob up. "Bob," I said, "I want to come down to Atlanta with the committee heads and have dinner with you." He was nervous, suspicious. "What's going on?" he asked. "What's the agenda?" "No agenda," I said. "We just want to clear the air." The four of us went down to Atlanta, Mitch Hart, who was the head of the technology committee, Bonnie Hill, the head of comp, John Clendenin, who was the head of audit, and myself. We sat down to dinner, and John Clendenin said, "Bob, before we start, I want to say something. I don't know who you are, Bob. I thought I knew you, but I don't know who you are, and that scares me." "What do you mean?" Nardelli asked. "What are you doing here?" Clendenin said. "Your behavior. We're doing all we can for you, Bob, and we're trying to help you. We're paying you more than we owe you, and we're happy with that. But for whatever reason, it always seems like it's you versus us, or us versus you. We've got to fix this." Well, Bob listened. He said he was trying to right the ship. There was a lot of work to be done to make that happen, he said. But he emphasized that he was all in, and then some. Nobody had ever criticized his work ethic. His tone was conciliatory, and the tension around the table eased. It wound up being a nice dinner. A week later, in early December, I got a call from Andy Taussig, our banker at Lehman Brothers. "Ken, I don't know what's going on," he said, "but Nardelli's bringing a group of senior people up to New York on Monday to meet with us and two other bankers. They've also got three PR firms lined up to interview, and they want us to line up three law firms." "For what?" I asked. "Apparently they've been approached by one of these activist groups, and they want to get ready," Taussig said, "but you can't let Bob know I told you." This pissed me off. The board had already agreed what to do if an activist group moved on us. The entire board was to be notified immediately, along with Marty Lipton. Nardelli was acting like a law unto himself. Friday afternoon around 3 o'clock, Nardelli calls me up. He told me he'd received a fax from relational investors listing several issues at Home Depot they considered critical and strongly hinting they were about to mount a proxy fight for control of the company. When did you get this fax? I asked. Came in on Wednesday, Nardelli said. And you're only calling me on Friday to tell me? Bob said impatiently that the fax had come in on a machine in the investor relations department that nobody ever looked at and had set on notice for 2 days. And thanks to what Andy Tausig had told me, I didn't believe a word he said. What are your thoughts? I asked him. I knew he had moved ahead without telling me, but I couldn't tell him I knew. My senior staff and I are coming to New York Monday morning, he said. We're going to interview 3 banking firms, 3 law firms, 3 PR firms. You'll do no such thing, I said, Bob. The board has made it clear that anything like this comes directly to the entire board, not just you. Cancel those meetings. We're going to have a board call. On Friday night at 10, all 12 members of the Home Depot board, including Bob and Marty Lipton, got on a conference call to discuss how we would respond to relational investors. We all agreed that Nardelli should cancel the meetings he'd set up. We confirmed that Wachtell Lipton would represent us legally, but we decided that we didn't want a PR firm or an investment banking firm yet. We were a wounded company. Publicity in a battle with an activist fund would be a delicate matter. And as for which banker we should choose, as Marty Lipton later told me, look, you should pick somebody you really trust because many bankers, when they find out this is going on, will run ahead of you and try to encourage another firm to come after you. To try to take us over, in other words. Business can be brutal, as I've said time and again. Just how brutal I would find out very soon. On the Sunday morning after the conference call, the board had another call, and John Clendenin, who was a very quiet, honorable, decent man, was still fuming about Nardelli. We're the board, he yelled. This wasn't his decision to make. Throughout December, it became increasingly clear that Home Depot's board was losing confidence in Bob. Then on the day after Christmas, several directors phoned me and told me that Nardelli was seeking their votes to throw me off the board. You're kidding me, I said, though I put it in somewhat stronger terms. That's what he did. I told him I would think about what to do next. That was Tuesday, December 26, 2006, the same day Gerald Ford died. The next day, Greg Brenneman and Lave Jackson called me again and said they felt Bob had to go. I agreed. But fellas, I said, we're going to do this in an orderly way. We're going to decide as a board, not as individuals. On Friday, December 29th, I got on the phone with the head members of the executive committee, and we all agreed that it was time for Nardelli to step down. We decided to have a special board meeting in Dallas on January 2nd. We were going to be closed for business on New Year's Day, and Tuesday the 2nd had been declared a national day of mourning for President Ford. I said I would tell Bob to be there. As to who would replace Bob, the 5 of us were all agreed. The clear choice was our vice chairman, Frank Blake. Nardelli had brought Blake over from GE, where he'd been the general counsel of the Power Systems Division and senior VP for business development. Frank had a stellar resume. He'd graduated from Harvard and Columbia Law, had clerked for the Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens, and had been deputy counsel for the first President Bush. And he was as quiet and thoughtful as Nardelli was hard-charging. Despite his achievements, there was a certain humility to Frank Blake, a quality that in some people's eyes might have not made him the first choice to lead a big company like Home Depot. But I believed in him strongly. We were still on the conference call. I was at my home in Florida. Mitch Hart and Greg Brenneman were skiing in Vail, Colorado. Bonnie Hill was in California. Only Clendenin was in Atlanta, where he lived. I knew that Blake was also there. John, go talk to Frank, I said. Tell him it's highly confidential. But ask him if the job were offered to him, would he take it? If Frank was willing, we would then have to get the whole board's approval. I then got Marty Lipton on the phone, and we called Nardelli to tell him we were going to have a special board meeting on Tuesday the 2nd. Bob immediately sensed what it was all about. You can't do that, he said. Marty Lipton spoke up. No, I'm sorry, Bob, he said. Any director can call a board meeting. All he has to do is give you 48 hours notice, and this is more than 48 hours. There was nothing Nardelli could say. John Clendenin had called me back at noon. I spoke to Frank, he said. He wants to think about it. Tell him he's got 3 hours, I said. John called Frank back at 3 o'clock, and Frank said, if it's offered, I'll take it. John phoned me with the news. Don't say anything to anybody, I told him. Bob doesn't know about this. Nardelli phoned me the next morning, Saturday. Ken, I admire you and love you and respect you, he said. You're my coach, my mentor, my idol. This is a father and son having a family spat. Bob, when you've got 300,000 people, the total number of Home Depot employees, depending on you to make the right decision, that's not a family, I told him. That's 300,000 lives. This is beyond family, I said. Bob, let me make it clear. I'm only one vote, but as far as I'm concerned, it's time for you to go. Can I come down and see you? He asked. Talk about all this? I don't want to see you, Bob. I've made my mind up. It's time. A deep silence on the other end of the line. Bob, I said, on Tuesday, you're going to have a chance to present your case, and the board is going to have to make a decision. Does it want to continue on, or does it want to make a change? I have no authority to speak for any other director, so what I'm saying to you right now is strictly me, I told. What the rest of the board does, they'll do. They're all very independent, strong-willed people. The directors were scattered around the country, so I reserved a couple of conference rooms at Dalforth, the General Aviation Terminal at Love Field, Dallas, the most central spot for the meeting. We gathered there on Tuesday afternoon, January 2nd. Marty Lipton was present to tell us what our obligations were and what the process should be to make sure every T was crossed and every I was dotted. Frank Blake was waiting in another room. Bob had the floor first, and what he talked about, to no surprise, was his numbers. This is what it was when I took over. This is what it is now. This is what happened in between. Sales, revenue, net earnings, all up, all unimpeachable. He never mentioned morale. He never mentioned his 2,300 HR people. I sat there fascinated. My first impression of Bob Nardelli, he's a real people guy. We've got a great operator here, had been exactly 50% right. The guy really was a great operator, but I came to realize too damn slowly that the whole people equation of Home Depot, the essence of our culture, had completely eluded him. To me, the whole issue with Bob was a damage to the culture. There's nothing like these people in our stores. They're special. Now, how do you get all these special people? Well, you start by treating them special. You let them know they matter. You let them know you appreciate their opinion. You let them know that if they think there's a better way of doing things than the way they're doing them, they have an obligation to tell us, and we have an obligation to listen. You also let them know that anybody can build a big store space and put all kinds of inventory in it. The glue that holds Home Depot together are these values. We don't just say them, we believe them, and we practice them consistently. Now, Bob had developed the mindset that these people who started at well over minimum wage and got a raise every year if their performance reviews were good, were a cost. And they were a cost. They were a significant part of the company's overall cost, and therefore Bob spent a lot of time trying to figure out how he could take that cost down. In my mind, it was like the reverse of the straw and the camel's back. Nardelli kept taking one straw off, and it reached a point where something very valuable was being lost. He finally finished his pitch, and we asked him to leave the room so the board could discuss what was going to happen next. Since I was chairing the meeting, I spoke first. Okay, I said. First of all, nobody has the luxury of not having an opinion. We're all going to have to take a stand one way or the other. Bob had brought two people onto the board during his tenure. There was Tom Ridge, the former governor of Pennsylvania and one-time head of Homeland Security, and Helen Johnson Leopold of the S.C. Johnson family, who'd just come on a few months earlier. Helen asked to abstain because she felt she hadn't been around the company long enough to develop an informed opinion. Rich took the position that Bob should not be fired. All 11 of the other directors felt Nardelli should leave. A brief discussion about Frank Blake followed. Some of the directors wanted to name him acting CEO rather than give him the position outright. For one thing, Frank had never led a company. Maybe his quiet personality was also giving some people pause. Wait a minute, I said. Let's cut his legs off. He'll have a better chance of succeeding. We've just proven we have the courage to fire a CEO. Let's have the guts to pass power without reservations. And so we voted Frank in immediately. Marty Lipton and I went into the room where Bob was sitting with his lawyers. Bob, I said, the board has made its decision. We wish you good luck. I'm going to hang around to negotiate your severance contract, and there's nothing more to say. We appreciate your service. We think you did a lot of good things, but we think at this juncture it's time for you to go one way and us to go another way. Marty and I went to the room where Frank Blake had been waiting and told him the good news. The three of us returned to the conference room. Ladies and gentlemen, I said, meet your new CEO. Everybody applauded warmly. The first thing Frank did was fascinating. When I asked him, "Frank, is there anything I can do for you right now?" he said, "Yes, I'd like to talk to Bernie Marcus." Bernie had retired at age 73 in 2002, and as the company's co-founder, he was passionately tuned into Home Depot's every move, and he hated almost everything Bob Nardelli had done as CEO. He wasn't shy about expressing his opinions to Bob either, and the blood between them eventually got so bad that the two of them stopped speaking. I placed the call to Bernie, and when I told him we'd just given the job to Frank Blake, his reaction was short and not so sweet. "Another GE guy," he said. "Yeah, another GE guy, Bernie, but this is a very different guy. You're going to see." "Hum," he said, sounding anything but convinced. I tried to tell him that Frank was his own man, a totally different person from Nardelli. Bernie still wasn't having any. I hoped he might eventually come around. "Bernie," I said, "I've got someone here who wants to talk to you," and I handed the phone to Frank. "Bernie, Frank Blake," Frank said. "Listen, Bernie, I want to tell you that I'm looking forward to my responsibilities leading this great company that you and Arthur and Ken founded. I think it's a great opportunity, and I'm excited about the future. But I'm going to need your help and your insight." I could tell from looking at Frank's face that it was a hard sell. But at the end of the call, Bernie, Frank, and I agreed we'd meet for breakfast in Palm Beach the following Sunday morning to discuss the path forward. After Frank left for Atlanta, Marty and I sat down with Bob and his lawyers to finalize the severance. The board had agreed we'd give Nardelli $18 million. By the way, he had 90 days to exercise those of his stock options that were in the money, and most of them were not in the money. His options package wound up being essentially worthless, the furthest thing from that reported $200 million. If Bob was agreeable to his settlement, we said, we would offer him the choice of spreading his severance over 4 years to allow for tax planning or taking it all at once. But the minute we began talking, Bob's lawyer started nickel and diming me on some bullshit insurance policy. "I'm going to tell you something," I said to his lawyer. "My plane is right downstairs. If this contract isn't signed in 5 minutes, I'm getting on a plane and I'm flying to Palm Beach, and you're going to be wired $18 million tomorrow morning, and we're all done. If he wants to fuck around, we'll fuck around, and he'll be the loser." Bob signed the agreement like that and left. I've rarely seen him since. We're cordial with each other, but distant. The next morning, bright and early, I ran into Larry Bossidy in the North Palm Beach community where we both live. Larry was a former chairman and CEO of Honeywell. Before that, he was vice chairman at GE, a very, very talented guy and a very close friend. Nardelli's firing was all over the newspapers. His supposed pay package was the issue of the time. "Well, you really screwed this one up," Larry said. "What are you talking about?" "Frank Blake worked for me at GE, and he's no CEO." "Well, we disagree," I said. "Poker's my favorite game, and I'm pretty good at it. Don't ever play me in poker." But the truth is that at that moment, I didn't know exactly what kind of hand I was holding with Frank Blake. What I did know is that he was a very smart man and a very good man. I knew that he and his wife Liz were devoutly religious. I knew he carried himself humbly and wasn't afraid to ask questions. But putting aside how good Blake was or wasn't, I pushed for him because I had a gun at my head. I knew we had to leave that room with a leader. Did I know that Frank Blake would be as strong a leader as he turned out to be? Of course not. But I was in a poker mode, and I liked Frank Blake's chances. "Well, Larry, you're wrong," I said. "In fact, I feel so certain. How much do you want to bet?" "I'll bet you $10,000, Larry said. "Okay," I said. "The loser pays $10,000 to the charity of the winner's choice. Now, how do we decide whether I win or lose?" "I say he won't be there in 6 months." "I'll tell you how good I feel about Frank," I said. "He's got to make it a year. If it was just 6 months, we might say, ah, give him a little bit more time. If he doesn't make it a year, you'll tell me the name of your charity." Frank wasn't a slam dunk by any means. The first breakfast with Bernie set the tone. Bernie was downright chilly with our new CEO, maybe even a little cooler than chilly, and Frank inherited a company that had been set back on its heels. The stock was flat, morale hadn't improved, and the stores, thanks in part to Nardelli's HR implants, were riddled with suspicion. Frank phased out the HR people, but he did a lot more than that. He visited store after store and made it clear at every Home Depot he walked into that he was there to listen and learn. He acknowledged and celebrated the company culture that Bob Nardelli had found so irrelevant. He made a fan of every sales associate he met. It's easy for a commanding general to impress a foot soldier. Now, Dolly certainly had an air of command, but Frank Blake had a different way of impressing people. He didn't throw his weight around. He didn't yell. He had a way of making everyone he talked to feel as important as he was. He dressed like a plumber, and he looked like a nerd. It was clear that he was a brilliant man, and like most brilliant people, he was endlessly curious. He truly cared about what was happening in those stores, down to the smallest detail. At one location we visited together in Columbus, Ohio, I noticed he was carrying a piece of paper with some figures on it. "What have you got?" I asked him. "I want to go see something," he said. I followed him down an aisle to a display of augers and auger bits. It turned out that Frank wanted to check the pricing on augers because someone had told him the tools had been mispriced in our stores. Well, they hadn't been, but Frank had to see for himself. Proving that the big picture depends on a lot of smaller pictures, Frank Blake became a rock star to the employees, and he gradually won Bernie's acceptance, and then his deep affection. Simply by picking up the phone and calling him whenever he had a question he felt Bernie could answer best. None of it happened right away. Frank's first year was tough, but when it did happen, the company was in a better place than it had ever been in before. Every now and then to this day, Bernie still likes to give me a hard time about the ditch Nardelli drove Home Depot into. And what I say back to him is this: go ask Frank Blake if he would have come here if Nardelli hadn't been here first. A year to the day after Frank Blake became CEO of Home Depot, right down to the very day, I called Larry Bossidy first thing in the morning. "Larry," I said, "you got a check around in the pen?" "What do you mean?" "Well, I'd like you to make a check out for $10,000 to the Boys Club in New York." "Why?" Larry said. "You forgot? I just spoke to Frank at 6:30 in the morning and he was still there." I would like to mention a couple of other small details about Frank Blake, because he would never tell you about them himself. He not only has a superb intellect, he's the best listener I've ever met, hands down. If he's talking with a group of people and someone says something interesting, Frank will stop speaking immediately and give the floor to that person. He has the greatest quantity of humility I've ever seen in a man. I don't need to tell you how rare that is in a chief executive. When we first negotiated his salary, he had three stipulations. Number one, he didn't want his compensation to be such that it would be on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. Number two, he didn't want it to be an embarrassment to the Home Depot sales associates, the kind of thing customers might bring up in a critical way. And number three, he wanted 90% of his pay to be in stock. "When the shareholders win, I win," he said. Talk about having skin in the game. And on more than one occasion, Frank donated his annual bonus, a sum in the millions, to the company's Homer Fund, which provides emergency money to associates in need and gives scholarships to their children. I would also like to say a final word about my faulty judgment in hiring Bob Nardelli. As with Steve Sato at IVAC, Bob was a great leader until he wasn't. Was I too slow in both cases to see the writing on the wall? Definitely. Both guys were racking up great numbers but ignoring the human equation. And in business, good numbers can be like sunlight, blindingly bright. But did my insecurity, my need to be liked, get in the way of letting these guys go before more damage was done? Definitely not. It's no fun to fire somebody. Still, in business, you don't have the luxury of not holding people accountable to the highest possible standards. You owe it to the company to do the right thing. And when it comes to making those tough decisions, I have no problem at all. I also have no problem admitting my mistakes. I'm loaded with them, but I never bought a pencil without an eraser on it, and God invented erasers on pencils for people like me. Chapter 9, Net Worth. When I was 10 years old, I was an altar boy at St. Mary's Church in Roslyn, just across the harbor from the sandpits. The priest, Father Francis Ryan, Father Frank, came from Ireland, spoke with a brogue, and had a boxer's nose. He really had been a boxer. Does it sound like a Spencer Tracy movie yet? I've always been spiritual, and I loved being an altar boy. The hours were challenging, though. When it was my turn to serve the 6:30 Mass for the week, I had to get up at 6 every morning from Monday until Saturday and walk about a mile to a spot underneath the railroad bridge at Roslyn Road where Mr. Harnett, the church sexton, would pick me up in his little Ford Model A and drive me the remaining 2 miles to St. Mary's. I remember the smell of the pipe Mr. Harnett smoked and the fragrance of the inside of the church, a combination of incense and the wood of the pews and the bindings of the hymnals. Weekdays, I'd serve mass, then walk back up the hill and go to school. But on Saturdays, I had to walk all the way home, 3 miles. Once I took a ride from my Uncle Pat, my father's